So this is a very powerful gospel story. In a sense, it's a continuation of Christmas because in the Nativity and the Epiphany, we get a revelation of who God is. And so too, in tonight's gospel, we get another revelation of who Jesus is, who God in Jesus Christ is. And it's a beautiful scene. We have Jesus being baptized, a tradition among John the Baptist's followers, Jesus getting in the waters with the rest of the people. But he hearing this voice, whether he alone or with all the crowds, this voice, "You are my beloved son. With you I am well pleased." You are my beloved. It's remarkable because we get very few glimpses of Jesus before that. We get the Nativity, we get Jesus being found in the temple at 12, and then a long gap of maybe 18 years. We get nothing of who Jesus was as an adolescent, as a teenager, as a young adult making his way in the world, learning his craft, relating to his family. We get no glimpse. What Ignatius of Loyola in the Spiritual Exercises calls the hidden life and invites us to pray in the hidden life. Imagine what Jesus was like growing up. And then he comes to the Jordan. And he's baptized. "You are my beloved son. With you I am well pleased." That's all we hear. There is no indication. There's no roadmap of the miracles, of the great crowds. There's no script given to Jesus about what he is to teach. There's no hint of Calvary or the empty tomb. Simply, "You are my beloved son." That's it. That's the only mission statement that Jesus gets. "You are my beloved son." Then he goes from the banks of the Jordan, and most curiously of all, he is led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted. Now, what a start to his ministry, right? Again, no miracles, no great crowds. He's led from the baptism where he's called his beloved son, God's beloved son, and he's led into the desert to be tempted. And the temptations were all about, if you are God's beloved son, then prove yourself. Prove yourself. Do mighty deeds. Prove yourself. In a sense, the desert tries to undo the Jordan in this most important regard. The good news of the Jordan River and our own baptism is that we do not have to earn God's love at all. We do not have to prove ourselves worthy of God's affection. It is given to us unconditionally, completely, without our even asking. That is, in a sense, the root of the gospel, the good news. It all begins there. This love of God given to us is unconditional. We don't have to prove it. And the devil in the desert says, "Prove it." And I can imagine Jesus in there hearing the echoes of the baptism in the Jordan. "No, you don't have to prove anything. You are my beloved." And so he doesn't take the bait. He doesn't prove himself at all to the devil. Instead, he chooses to live out his identity. In the years that would follow the baptism in the Jordan and the desert, he would prove it simply by doing what he was made to do. What we do flows from who we are. What we do flows from who we are. And so if we, you and I, could just claim our belovedness, life would be a whole lot easier. If what we do truly flowed from the deepest sense of who we are as God's beloved, life would be so much easier for ourselves and other people. But there are so many voices out in our world, particularly in our culture, that says, no, you have to prove yourself. You have to look a certain way or act a certain way, have a certain title, and then you will be loved. Do something in order to show you are accepted and loved unconditionally. Well, truth is, our world is filled with conditional love. But the gospel promise and the good news of the Jordan is you do not have to prove it. You are beloved, and your only job is to live out of it. James Allison is a theologian, and he often speaks on behalf of those who feel marginalized in the church and in the world. And he has a meditation on what does it mean truly to be God's beloved. And he writes this quite simply. If we truly believe that our own baptismal promise of being beloved, he writes, you will find yourself doing lovable things because you are loved. You will find yourself doing lovable things because you are loved. Start with that embrace of God's unconditional love. Maybe experienced through your parents or family, your spouse, your children, your friends. Experience God's beloved embrace and then just live out of it. It's so much easier that way. Rather than treating life or our faith like some sort of divine obstacle course to get to heaven. Like we show a ticket when we get there. I don't think God's going to ask for a ticket. He's going to say, so, my beloved, did you live it? And he'll peer behind our shoulders and say, who did you bring with you? But yet we treat our faith like an obstacle course, an endurance contest. When God's initial message is, no, accept that you are beloved. And if we truly do, we will not risk sort of lapsing in the wading in the Jordan and sunning ourselves in the banks of the Jordan saying, let's stop here. This is too good to be true. Let's just enjoy ourselves by the Jordan. Well, maybe for a little bit. But if we truly grasp that we are God's beloved, that is going to impel us outward to do lovable things. To show this world of conditioned love what unconditional love looks like, to reveal the belovedness in other people, particularly those who don't feel very lovable. We summon lovableness out of other people. Imagine if that's what it meant to be a disciple. Summon belovedness. And there's lots of opportunities every day. Every day. Imagine just in our political discourse, if we, for some in our politics, if we didn't talk about migrants or undocumented persons as the other and instead called them beloved, that would change the way we talk about the undocumented. It would change the way we talk about the unborn or the way we talk about those at the end of life. In months where we have seen increasing Islamophobia, if we instead called our Muslim brothers and sisters as God's beloved children, we treat them so much different and talk about them differently too. You see how transformative this belovedness is. It's just not this saccharine Hallmark card type of sentimentality that demands nothing. Frankly, it demands a lot more than that obstacle course we construct if we truly live our belovedness. Let me close with a reflection given this month by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who in 1957 at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church said the following about this type of unconditional love, which the New Testament calls agape, a Greek word for love. This is what Martin Luther King says. Good words for us to hear today. Agape is a love that seeks nothing in return. It is an overflowing love. When you rise to love on this level, you begin to love men and women not because they are likable, but because God loves them. You look at every man and woman and you love them because you know God loves them. And they might be the worst person you have ever seen. And this is what Jesus means, I think, in the passage where he says, love your enemy. It's significant, King says, that Jesus does not say, like your enemy. Like is a sentimental something, an affectionate something. There are a lot of people I find difficult to like. I don't like what they do to me. I don't like what they say about me or other people. I don't like their attitudes. I don't like some of the things they're doing. I don't like them, but Jesus says, love them, and love is greater than like. He concludes, love is understanding and a redemptive goodwill for all people, so that you love everyone because God loves them. You refuse to do anything that will defeat an individual because you have agape in your soul. because you have agape in your soul. Well, that's because of our baptism, when we were called God's beloved. Agape in our soul. And now you and I have to just live that out.